This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of My Sister's Keeper by Jodi Picoult. Narrated by Julia Gibson, Jenny Ikeda, Barbara McCullough, Carol Monda, Andy Paris, Richard Poe, and Tom Stecciotti. This book is copyrighted 2004 by Jodi Picoult. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. The author writes, "Today's political and scientific battles over cloning and DNA and gene replacement therapy led me to think about some of what the future might hold on a personal level for people. And thus the story of Anna and Kate was born. In a way, I think of this book as Sophie's choice for the new millennium. If you use one of your children to save the life of another, are you being a good mother or a very bad one?" And now, My Sister's Keeper.
Prologue. From Vom Kriege by Karl von Clausewitz. No one starts a war, or rather no one in his sense ought to do so, without first being clear in his mind what he intends to achieve by that war and how he intends to conduct it. In my first memory, I am 3 years old, and I am trying to kill my sister. Sometimes the recollection is so clear I can remember the itch of the pillowcase under my hand, the sharp point of her nose pressing into my palm. She didn't stand a chance against me, of course, but it still didn't work. My father walked by, tucking in the house for the night, and saved her. He led me back to my own bed. That, he told me, never happened. As we got older, I didn't seem to exist, except in relation to her. I would watch her sleep across the room from me, one long shadow linking our beds, and I would count the ways. Poison sprinkled on her cereal. A wicked undertow off the beach, lightning striking. In the end, though, I did not kill my sister. She did it all on her own. Or at least, this is what I tell myself. Monday. From Kin by Carl Sandburg. Brother, I am fire, surging under ocean floor. I shall never meet you, brother. Not for years, anyhow. Maybe thousands of years, brother. Then I will warm you, hold you close, wrap you in circles, use you and change you. Maybe thousands of years, brother. Anna. When I was little, the great mystery to me wasn't how babies were made, but why. The mechanics I understood. My older brother Jesse had filled me in. Although, at the time, I was sure he'd heard half of it wrong. Other kids my age were busy looking up the words penis and vagina in the classroom dictionary when the teacher had her back turned. But I paid attention to different details, like why some mothers had only one child, while other families seemed to multiply before your eyes, or how the new girl in school, Sedona, told anyone who'd listen that she was named for the place where her parents were vacationing when they made her. Good thing they weren't staying in Jersey City, my father used to say. Now that I am 13, these distinctions are only more complicated. The eighth grader who dropped out of school because she got into trouble. A neighbor who got herself pregnant in the hopes it would keep her husband from filing for divorce. I'm telling you, if aliens landed on Earth today and took a good hard look at why babies get born, they'd conclude that most people have children by accident, or because they drink too much on a certain night, or because birth control isn't 100%, or for a thousand other reasons that really aren't very flattering. On the other hand, I was born for a very specific purpose. I wasn't the result of a cheap bottle of wine or a full moon or the heat of the moment. I was born because a scientist managed to hook up my mother's eggs and my father's sperm to create a specific combination, a precious genetic material. In fact, when Jesse told me how babies get made and I, the great disbeliever, decided to ask my parents the truth, I got more than I bargained for. They sat me down and told me all the usual stuff, of course, but they also explained that they chose little embryonic me, specifically because I could save my sister, Kate. "We loved you even more," my mother made sure to say, "because we knew exactly what we were getting." It made me wonder, though, what would have happened if Kate had been healthy? Chances are I'd still be floating up in heaven or wherever, waiting to be attached to a body to spend some time on Earth. Certainly, I would not be part of this family. See, unlike the rest of the free world, I didn't get here by accident. And if your parents have you for a reason, then that reason better exist. Because once it's gone, so are you. Pawn shops may be full of junk, but they're also a breeding ground for stories, if you ask me. Not that you did. What happened to make a person trade in the never-before-worn diamond solitaire? Who needed money so badly they'd sell a teddy bear missing an eye? As I walk up to the counter, I wonder if someone will look at the locket I'm about to give up and ask these same questions. The man at the cash register has a nose the shape of a turnip and eyes sunk so deep I can't imagine how he sees well enough to go about his business. "Need something?" he asks. It's all I can do not to turn around and walk out the door, pretend I've come in by mistake. The only thing that keeps me steady is knowing I am not the first person to stand in front of this counter, holding the one item in the world I never thought I'd part with. "I have something to sell," I tell him.
"Am I supposed to guess what it is?"
"Oh." Swallowing, I pull the locket out of the pocket of my jeans. The heart falls on the glass counter in a pool of its own chain. "It's 14-karat gold," I pitch. "Hardly ever worn." This is a lie. Until this morning, I haven't taken it off in 7 years. My father gave it to me when I was 6 after the bone marrow harvest, because he said anyone who was giving her sister such a major present deserved one of her own. Seeing it there on the counter, my neck feels shivery and naked. The owner puts a loop up to his eye, which makes it seem almost normal size.
"I'll give you 20.
"Dollars?"
"No, pesos. What do you think?"
"It's worth 5 times that."
"I'm guessing."
The owner shrugs.
"I'm not the one who needs the money."
I pick up the locket, resigned to sealing the deal, and the strangest thing happens. My hand, it just clamps shut like the jaws of life. My face goes red with the effort to peel apart my fingers. It takes what seems like an hour for that locket to spill into the owner's outstretched palm. His eyes stay on my face, softer now.
"Tell them you lost it," he offers, advice tossed in for free.
If Mr. Webster had decided to put the word freak in his dictionary, Anna Fitzgerald would be the best definition he could give. It's more than just the way I look, refugee skinny with absolutely no chest to speak of, hair the color of dirt, connect-the-dot freckles on my cheeks that, let me tell you, do not fade with lemon juice or sunscreen or even, sadly, sandpaper. No. God was obviously in some kind of mood on my birthday, because he added to this fabulous physical combination the bigger picture, the household into which I was born. My parents tried to make things normal, but that's a relative term. The truth is, I was never really a kid. To be honest, neither were Cade and Jesse. I guess maybe my brother had his moment in the sun for the 4 years he was alive before Kate got diagnosed, but ever since then, we've been too busy looking over our shoulders to run headlong into growing up. You know how most little kids think they're like cartoon characters? If an anvil drops on their heads, they can peel themselves off the sidewalk and keep going? Well, I never once believed that. How could I, when we practically set a place for death at the dinner table? Kate has acute promyelocytic leukemia. Actually, that's not quite true. Right now, she doesn't have it, but it's hibernating under her skin like a bear until it decides to roar again. She was diagnosed when she was 2. She's 16 now. Molecular relapse and granulocyte and portacath. These words are part of my vocabulary, even though I'll never find them on any SAT. I'm an allogeneic donor, a perfect sibling match. When Kate needs leukocytes or stem cells or bone marrow to fool her body into thinking it's healthy, I'm the one who provides them. Nearly every time Kate's hospitalized, I wind up there too. None of which means anything except that you shouldn't believe what you hear about me, least of all, that which I tell you myself. As I am coming up the stairs, my mother comes out of her room wearing another ball gown. "Ah," she says, turning her back to me, "just the girl I wanted to see." I zip it up and watch her twirl. My mother could be beautiful if she were parachuted into someone else's life. She has long, dark hair and the fine collarbones of a princess, but the corners of her mouth turn down like she's swallowed bitter news. She doesn't have much free time, since a calendar is something that can change drastically if my sister develops a bruise or a nosebleed. But what she does have, she spends at bluefly.com, ordering ridiculously fancy evening dresses for places she is never going to go. "What do you think?" she asks. The gown is all the colors of sunset and made out of material that swishes when she moves. It's strapless, what a star might wear sashaying down a red carpet. Totally not the dress code for a suburban house in Upper Darby, Rhode Island. My mother twists her hair into a knot and holds it in place. On her bed are 3 other dresses, one slinky and black, one bugle beaded, one that seems impossibly small. "You look tired." The word bubbles right under my lips. My mother goes perfectly still, and I wonder if I've said it without meaning to. She holds up a hand, shushing me, her ear cocked to the open doorway. "Did you hear that?" "Hear what?" "Kate." "I didn't hear anything." But she doesn't take my word for it, because when it comes to Kate, she doesn't take anybody's word for it. She marches upstairs and opens up our bedroom door to find my sister hysterical on her bed. And just like that, the world collapses again. My father, a closet astronomer, has tried to explain black holes to me, how they are so heavy they absorb everything, even light, right into their center. Moments like this are the same kind of vacuum. No matter what you cling to, you wind up being sucked in. "Kate!" My mother sinks down to the floor, that stupid skirt a cloud around her. "Kate, honey, what hurts?" Kate hugs a pillow to her stomach, and tears keep streaming down her face. Her pale hair is stuck to her face in damp streaks. Her breathing's too tight. I stand frozen in the doorway of my own room, waiting for instructions. Call Daddy. Call 911. Call Dr. Chance. My mother goes so far as to shake a better explanation out of Kate. "It's Preston," she sobs. "He's leaving Serena for good." That's when we notice the TV. On the screen, a blonde hottie gives a longing look to a woman crying almost as hard as my sister, and then he slams the door. "But what hurts?" my mother asks, certain there has to be more to it than this. "Oh my God," Kate says, sniffling. "Do you have any idea how much Serena and Preston have been through? Do you?" That fist inside me relaxes now that I know it's all right. Normal in our house is like a blanket, too short for a bed. Sometimes it covers you just fine, and other times it leaves you cold and shaking. And worst of all, you never know which of the two it's going to be. I sit down on the end of Kate's bed. Although I'm only 13, I'm taller than her,
and every now and then people mistakenly assume I'm the older sister. At different times this summer, she has been crazy for Callahan, Wyatt, and Liam, the male leads on this soap. Now, I guess, it's all about Preston. There was the kidnapping scare, I volunteer. I actually followed that storyline. Kate made me tape the show during her dialysis sessions. And the time she almost married his twin by mistake, Kate adds. Don't forget when he died in the boat accident. For 2 months, anyway. My mother joins the conversation, and I remember that she used to watch this soap, too, sitting with Kate in the hospital. For the first time, Kate seems to notice my mother's outfit. What are you wearing? Oh, something I'm sending back. She stands up in front of me so I can undo her zipper. This mail-order compulsion, for any other mother, would be a wake-up call for therapy. For my mom, it would probably be considered a healthy break. I wonder if it's putting on someone else's skin for a while that she likes so much. Or if it's the option of being able to send back a circumstance that just doesn't suit you. She looks at Kate, hard. You're sure nothing hurts? After my mother leaves, Kate sinks a little. That's the only way to describe it, how fast color drains from her face, how she disappears against the pillows. As she gets sicker, she fades a little more, until I am afraid one day I will wake up and not be able to see her at all. Move, Kate orders. You're blocking the picture. So I go to sit on my own bed. It's only the coming attractions. Well, if I die tonight, I want to know what I'm missing. I fluff my pillows under my head. Kate, as usual, has swapped so that she has all the funchy ones that don't feel like rocks under your neck. She's supposed to deserve this, because she's 3 years older than me, or because she's sick, or because the moon is in Aquarius. There's always a reason. I squint at the television, wishing I could flip through the stations, knowing I don't have a prayer. Preston looks like he's made out of plastic. Then why did I hear you whispering his name last night in your pillow? Shut up, I say. You shut up. Then Kate smiles at me. He probably is gay, though. Quite a waste, considering the Fitzgerald sisters are... Wincing, she breaks off mid-sentence and I roll toward her. Kate? She rubs her lower back. It's nothing. It's her kidneys. Want me to get Mom? Not yet. She reaches between our beds, which are just far apart enough for us to touch each other if we both try. I hold out my hand, too. When we were little, we'd make this bridge and try to see how many Barbies we could get to balance on it. Lately, I've been having nightmares, where I'm cut into so many pieces that there isn't enough of me to be put back together. My father says that a fire will burn itself out unless you open a window and give it fuel. I suppose that's what I'm doing, when you get right down to it. But then again, my dad also says that when flames are licking at your heels, you've got to break a wall or two if you want to escape. So when Kate falls asleep from her meds, I take the leather binder I keep between my mattress and box spring and go into the bathroom for privacy. I know Kate's been snooping. I rigged up a red thread between my zipper's teeth to let me know who was prying into my stuff without my permission. But even though the thread's been torn, there's nothing missing inside. I turn on the water in the bathtub so it sounds like I'm in there for a reason, and sit down on the floor to count. If you add in the $20 from the pawn shop, I have $136.87. It's not going to be enough, but there's got to be a way around that. Jesse didn't have $2,900 when he bought his beat-up Jeep, and the bank gave him some kind of loan. Of course, my parents had to sign the papers, too, and I doubt they're going to be willing to do that for me, given the circumstances. I count the money a second time, just in case the bills have miraculously reproduced. But math is math, and the total stays the same. And then I read the newspaper clippings. Campbell Alexander. It's a stupid name, in my opinion. It sounds like a bar drink that costs too much, or a brokerage firm. But you can't deny the man's track record. To reach my brother's room, you actually have to leave the house, which is exactly the way he likes it. When Jesse turned 16, he moved into the attic over the garage. A perfect arrangement, since he didn't want my parents to see what he was doing, and my parents didn't really want to see. Blocking the stairs to his place are 4 snow tires, a small wall of cartons, and an oak desk tipped onto its side. Sometimes I think Jesse sets up these obstacles himself, just to make getting to him more of a challenge. I crawl over the mess and up the stairs, which vibrate with the bass from Jesse's stereo. It takes nearly 5 whole minutes before he hears me knocking. "What?" he snaps, opening the door a crack. "Can I come in?" He thinks twice, then steps back to let me enter. The room is a sea of dirty clothes and magazines and leftover Chinese takeout cartons. It smells like the sweaty tongue of a hockey skate. The only neat spot is the shelf where Jesse keeps his special collection. A Jaguar's silver mascot, a Mercedes symbol, a Mustang's horse. Hood ornaments that he told me he just found lying around, although I'm not dumb enough to believe him. Don't get me wrong. It isn't that my parents don't care about Jesse or whatever trouble he's gotten himself mixed up in. It's just that they don't really have time to care about it, because it's a problem somewhere lower on the totem pole. Jesse ignores me, going back to whatever he was doing on the far side of the mess. My attention is caught by a crock pot, one that disappeared out of the kitchen a few months ago, which now sits on top of Jesse's TV with a copper tube threaded out of its lid and down through a plastic milk jug filled with ice, emptying into a glass mason jar. Jesse may be a borderline delinquent, but he's brilliant. Just as I'm about to touch the contraption, Jesse turns around. "Hey!" He fairly flies over the couch to knock my hand away. "You'll screw up the condensing coil." "Is this what I think it is?" A nasty grin inches over his face. "Depends on what you think it is." He jimmies out the mason jar so that liquid drips onto the carpet. "Have a taste." For a still made out of spit and glue, it produces pretty potent moonshine whiskey. An inferno races so fast through my belly and legs I fall back onto the couch. "Disgusting," I gasp. Jesse laughs and takes a swig too, although for him it goes down easier. "So, what do you want from me?" "How do you know I want something?" "Because no one comes up here on a social call," he says, sitting on the arm of the couch. "And if it was something about Kate, you would have already told me." "It is about Kate, sort of." I press the newspaper clippings into my brother's hand. They'll do a better job explaining than I ever could. He scans them, then looks me right in the eye. His are the palest shade of silver, so surprising that sometimes when he stares at you, you can completely forget what you were planning to say.
"Don't mess with the system, Anna," he says bitterly. "We've all got our scripts down pat. Kate plays the martyr, I'm the lost cause, and you're the peacekeeper."
He thinks he knows me, but that goes both ways. And when it comes to friction, Jesse is an addict. I look right at him.
"Says who?"
Jesse agrees to wait for me in the parking lot. It's one of the few times I can recall him doing anything I tell him to do. I walk around to the front of the building, which has 2 gargoyles guarding its entrance. Campbell Alexander Esquire's office is on the 3rd floor. The walls are paneled with wood the color of a chestnut mare's coat, and when I step onto the thick oriental rug on the floor, my sneakers sink an inch. The secretary is wearing black pumps so shiny I can see my own face in them. I glance down at my cutoffs
and the kids that I tattooed last week with magic markers when I was bored. The secretary has perfect skin and perfect eyebrows and honeybee lips, and she's using them to scream bloody murder at whoever is on the other end of the phone. You cannot expect me to tell a judge that. Just because you don't want to hear Kleeman rant and rave doesn't mean that I have to. No, actually, that raise was for the exceptional job I do and the crap I put up with on a daily basis. And, as a matter of fact, while we're on... She holds the phone away from her ear, and I can make out the buzz of disconnection. Bastard, she mutters, and then seems to realize I'm standing 3 feet away. Can I help you? She looks me over from head to toe, rating me on a general scale of first impressions, and finding me severely lacking. I lift my chin and pretend to be far more cool than I actually am. I have an appointment with Mr. Alexander at 4 o'clock. Your voice, she says. On the phone, you didn't sound quite so... young. She smiles uncomfortably. We don't try juvenile cases as a rule. If you'd like, I can offer you the names of some practicing attorneys who... I take a deep breath. Actually, I interrupt, you're wrong. Smith v. Watley, Edmonds v. Women's and Infants Hospital, and Jerome v. the Diocese of Providence all involve litigants under the age of 18. All three resulted in verdicts from Mr. Alexander's clients, and those were just in the past year. The secretary blinks at me. Then a slow smile toasts her face, as if she's decided she just might like me after all. Come to think of it, why don't you just wait in his office? She suggests, and she stands up to show me the way. Even if I spend every minute of the rest of my life reading, I do not believe that I will ever manage to consume the sheer number of words routed high and low on the walls of Campbell Alexander Esquire's office. I do the math. If there are 400 words or so on every page, and each of those legal books are 400 pages, and there are 20 on a shelf and 6 shelves per bookcase, why, you're pushing 19 million words, and that's only partway across the room. I'm alone in the office long enough to note that his desk is so neat you could play Chinese football on the blotter, that there is not a single photo of a wife or a kid or even himself, and that, in spite of the fact that the room is spotless, there is a mug full of water sitting on the floor. I find myself making up explanations. It's a swimming pool for an army of ants. It's some kind of primitive humidifier. It's a mirage. I've nearly convinced myself about the last one, and am leaning over to touch it to see if it's real, when the door bursts open. I practically fall out of my chair, and that puts me eye to eye with an incoming German shepherd, which spears me with a look and then marches over to the mug and starts to drink. Campbell Alexander comes in, too. He's got black hair, and he's at least as tall as my dad, 6 feet, with a right-angled jaw and eyes that look frozen over. He shrugs out of a suit jacket and hangs it neatly on the back of the door, then yanks a file out of a cabinet before moving to his desk. He never makes eye contact with me, but he starts talking all the same. I don't want any Girl Scout cookies, Campbell Alexander says, although you do get brownie points for tenacity. He smiles at his own joke. I'm not selling anything. He glances at me curiously, then pushes a button on his phone. Carrie, he says when the secretary answers, what is this doing in my office? I'm here to retain you, I say. The lawyer releases the intercom button. I don't think so. You don't even know if I have a case. I take a step forward. So does the dog. For the first time, I realize it's wearing one of those vests with a red cross on it, like a St. Bernard that might carry rum up a snowy mountain. I automatically reach out to pet him. Don't, Alexander says. Judge is a service dog. My hand goes back to my side. But
You aren't blind.
Thank you for pointing that out to me.
So, what's the matter with you?
The minute I say it, I want to take it back. Haven't I watched Kate field this question from hundreds of rude people?
I have an iron lung, Campbell Alexander says curtly, and the dog keeps me from getting too close to magnets. Now, if you do me the exalted honor of leaving, my secretary can find you the name of someone who...
But I can't go yet. Did you really sue God? I take out all the newspaper clippings, smooth them on the bare desk. A muscle ticks in his cheek, and then he picks up the article lying on top.
I sued the Diocese of Providence on behalf of a kid in one of their orphanages who needed an experimental treatment involving fetal tissue, which they felt violated Vatican II. However, it makes a much better headline to say that a 9-year-old is suing God for being stuck with the short end of the straw in life.
I just stare at him.
Dylan Jerome, the lawyer admits, wanted to sue God for not caring enough about him.
A rainbow might as well have cracked down the middle of that big mahogany desk. Mr. Alexander, I say, my sister has leukemia.
I'm sorry to hear that. But even if I were willing to litigate against God again, which I'm not, you can't bring a lawsuit on someone else's behalf.
There is way too much to explain. My own blood seeping into my sister's veins. The nurses holding me down to stick me for white cells that Kate might borrow. The doctor saying they didn't get enough the first time around. The bruises and the deep bone ache after I gave up my marrow. The shots that sparked more stem cells in me so that there'd be extra for my sister. The fact that I'm not sick, but I might as well be. The fact that the only reason I was born was as a harvest crop for Kate. The fact that even now, a major decision about me is being made, and no one's bothered to ask the one person who most deserves it to speak her opinion. There's way too much to explain, and so I do the best I can. It's not God, just my parents, I say. I want to sue them for the rights to my own body.
Campbell. When you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. This is something my father, the first Campbell Alexander, used to say. It is also, in my opinion, the cornerstone of the American civil justice system. Simply put, people who have been backed into a corner will do anything to fight their way to the center again. For some, this means throwing punches. For others, it means instigating a lawsuit. And for that, I'm especially grateful. On the periphery of my desk, Carrie has arranged my messages the way I prefer. Urgent ones written on green post-its, less pressing matters on yellow ones. Lined up in neat columns like a double game of solitaire. One phone number catches my eye, and I frown, moving the green post-it to the yellow side instead. Your mother called 4 times, Carrie has written. On second thought, I rip the post-it in half and send it sailing into the trash. The girl sitting across from me waits for an answer, one I'm deliberately withholding. She says she wants to sue her parents, like every other teenager on the planet. But she wants to sue for the rights to her own body. It is exactly the kind of case I avoid like the Black Plague, one which requires far too much effort and client babysitting. With a sigh, I get up. What did you say your name was?
I didn't.
She sits a little straighter. It's Anna Fitzgerald. I open the door and bellow for my secretary. Carrie, can you get the Planned Parenthood number for Miss Fitzgerald?
What?
When I turn around, the kid is standing.
Planned Parenthood?
Look, Anna, here's a little advice. Instigating a lawsuit because your parents won't let you get birth control pills or go to an abortion clinic is like using a sledgehammer to kill a mosquito.
You can save your allowance money and go to Planned Parenthood. They're far better equipped to deal with your problem. For the first time since I've entered my office, I really, truly look at her. Anger glows around this kid like electricity. My sister is dying, and my mother wants me to donate one of my kidneys to her, she says hotly. Somehow I don't think a handful of free condoms is going to take care of that. You know how every now and then you have a moment where your whole life stretches out ahead of you like a forked road? And even as you choose one gritty path, you've got your eyes on the other the whole time, certain that you're making a mistake? Carrie approaches, holding out a strip of paper with a number I've asked for, but I close the door without taking it and walk back to my desk. No one can make you donate an organ if you don't want to.
Oh, really?
She leans forward, counting off on her fingers. The first time I gave something to my sister, it was cord blood, and I was a newborn. She has leukemia, APL, and my cells put her into remission. The next time she relapsed, I was 5, and I had lymphocytes drawn from me, 3 times over, because the doctors never seemed to get enough of them the first time around. When that stopped working, they took bone marrow for a transplant. When Kate got infections, I had to donate granulocytes. When she relapsed again, I had to donate peripheral blood stem cells. This girl's medical vocabulary would put some of my paid experts to shame. I pull a legal pad out of a drawer. Obviously, you've agreed to be a donor for your sister before. She hesitates, then shakes her head. Nobody ever asked. Did you tell your parents you don't want to donate a kidney? They don't listen to me. They might if you mentioned this. She looks down so that her hair covers her face. They don't really pay attention to me, except when they need my blood or something. I wouldn't even be alive if it wasn't for Kate being sick. An heir and a spare. This was a custom that went back to my ancestors in England. It sounded callous, having a subsequent child just in case the first one happens to die, yet it had been eminently practical once. Being an afterthought might not sit well with this kid, but the truth is that children are conceived for less than admirable reasons every single day. To glue a bad marriage together, to keep the family name alive, to mold in a parent's own image. They had me so that I could save Kate, the girl explains. They went to special doctors and everything, and picked the embryo that would be a perfect genetic match. There had been ethics courses in law school, but they were generally regarded either as a gut or an oxymoron, and I usually skipped them. Still, anyone who tuned in periodically to CNN would know about the controversies of stem cell research. Spare parts babies, designer infants, the science of tomorrow to save the children of today. I tap my pen on the desk and Judge, my dog, sidles closer. What happens if you don't give your sister a kidney? She'll die. And you're okay with that? Anna's mouth sets in a thin line.
I'm here, aren't I?
Yes, you are. I'm just trying to figure out what made you want to put your foot down after all this time. She looks over at the bookshelf.
Because, she says simply, it never stops.
Suddenly something seems to jog her memory. She reaches into her pocket and puts a wad of crumpled bills and change onto my desk.
You don't have to worry about getting paid, either. That's $136.87. I know it's not enough, but I'll figure out a way to get more.
I charge $200 an hour.
Dollars?
Wampum doesn't fit in the ATM deposit slot, I say.
Maybe I could walk your dog or something.
Service dogs get walked by their owners. I shrug. We'll work something out.
You can't be my lawyer for free, she insists.
Fine, then you can polish my doorknobs. It's not that I'm a particularly charitable man, but rather that legally this case is a lock. She doesn't want to give a kidney,
No court in its right mind would force her to give up a kidney. I don't have to do any legal research. The parents will cave in before we go to trial, and that will be that. Plus, the case will generate a ton of publicity for me, and will jack up my pro bono for the whole damn decade. I'm going to file a petition for you in family court. Legal emancipation for medical purposes, I say.
Then what?
There'll be a hearing, and the judge will appoint a guardian ad litem, which is a person trained to work with kids in the family court, who determines what's in the child's best interests, Anna recites. Or, in other words, just another grown-up deciding what happens to me. Well, that's the way the law works, and you can't get around it. But a GAL is theoretically only looking out for you, not your sister or your parents. She watches me take out a legal pad and scrawl a few notes. Does it bother you that your name is backward? What? I stop writing and stare at her. Campbell Alexander. Your last name is a first name, and your first name is a last name. She pauses. Or a soup. And how does that have any bearing on your case?
It doesn't, Anna admits.
Except that it was a pretty bad decision your parents made for you. I reach across my desk to hand her a card. If you have any questions, call me. She takes it and runs her fingers over the raised lettering of my name. My backward name, for the love of God. Then she leans across the desk, grabs my pad, and tears the bottom off the page. Borrowing my pen, she writes something down and hands it back to me. I glance down at the note in my hand. Anna, 555-3211, followed by a heart.
If you have any questions, she says.
When I walk out to the reception area, Anna is gone, and Carrie sits at her desk, a catalog spread-eagled across it. Did you know they used to use those L.L. Bean canvas bags to carry ice?
Yeah.
And vodka and Bloody Mary mix, toted from the cottage to the beach every Saturday morning. Which reminds me, my mother called. Carrie has an aunt who makes her living as a psychic, and every now and then this genetic predisposition rears its head. Or maybe she's just been working for me long enough to know most of my secrets. At any rate, she knows what I'm thinking. She says your father's taken up with a 17-year-old, and that discretion isn't in his vocabulary, and that she's checking herself into the pines unless you call her by... Carrie glances at her watch. Oops. How many times has she threatened to commit herself this week?
Only 3, Carrie says.
We're still way below average. I lean over the desk and close the catalog. Time to earn a living, Miss Donatelli.
What's going on?
That girl, Anna Fitzgerald.
Planned Parenthood?
Not quite, I say. We're representing her. I need to dictate a petition for medical emancipation so that you can file it with the family court by tomorrow.
Get out! You're representing her?
I put a hand over my heart. I'm wounded that you think so little of me.
Actually, I was thinking about your wallet. Do her parents know?
They will by tomorrow.
Are you a complete idiot?
Excuse me? Carrie shakes her head.
Where's she going to live?
The comment stops me. In fact, I hadn't really considered it. But a girl who brings a lawsuit against her parents will not be particularly comfortable residing under the same roof once the papers are served. Suddenly, Judge is at my side, pushing against my thigh with his nose. I shake my head, annoyed. Timing is everything. Give me 15 minutes, I tell Carrie. I'll call you when I'm ready.
Campbell,
Carrie presses, relentless. You can't expect a kid to fend for herself. I head back into my office. Judge follows, pausing just inside the threshold. It's not my problem, I say. And then I close the door, lock it securely, and wait.
Sarah, 1990.
The bruise is the size and shape of a four-leaf clover and sits square between Kate's shoulder blades. Jesse is the one to find it while they are both in the bathtub. "Mommy," he asks, "does that mean she's lucky?" I try to rub it off first, assuming it's dirt, without success. Kate, too, the subject of scrutiny, stares up at me with her china blue eyes. "Does it hurt?" I ask her, and she shakes her head. Somewhere in the hallway behind me, Brian is telling me about his day. He smells faintly of smoke. "So the guy bought a case of expensive cigars," he says, "and had them insured against fire for $15,000. Next thing you know, the insurance company gets a claim saying all the cigars were lost in a series of small fires." "He smoked them?" I say, washing the soap out of Jesse's hair. Brian leans against the threshold of the door. "Yeah, but the judge ruled that the company guaranteed the cigars as insurable against fire without defining acceptable fire." "Hey, Kate, does it hurt now?" Jesse says, and he presses his thumb hard against the bruise on his sister's spine. Kate howls, lurches, and spills bathwater all over me. I lift her out of the water, slick as a fish, and pass her over to Brian. Pale towheads bent together, they are a matched set. Jesse looks more like me, skinny, dark, cerebral. Brian says this is how we know our family is complete. We each have our clone. "You get yourself out of the tub this minute," I tell Jesse. He stands up, a sluice of four-year-old boy, and manages to trip as he navigates the wide lip of the tub. He smacks his knee hard and bursts into tears. I gather Jesse into a towel, soothing him as I try to continue my conversation with my husband. This is the language of a marriage, Morse code punctuated by baths and dinners and stories before bed. "So who subpoenaed you?" I ask Brian. "The defendant?" "The prosecution. The insurance company paid out the money and then had him arrested for 24 counts of arson. I got to be their expert." Brian, a career firefighter, can walk into a blackened structure and find the spot where the flames began. A charred cigarette butt, an exposed wire. Every Holocaust starts with an ember. You just have to know what to look for. The judge threw out the case, right? The judge sentenced him to 24 consecutive one-year terms, Brian says. He puts Kate down on the floor and begins to pull her pajamas over her head. In my previous life, I was a civil attorney. At one point, I truly believed that was what I wanted to be. But that was before I'd been handed a fistful of crushed violets from a toddler. Before I understood that the smile of a child is a tattoo, indelible art. It drives my sister Suzanne crazy. She's a finance whiz who decimated the glass ceiling at the Bank of Boston. And according to her, I am a waste of cerebral evolution. But I think half the battle is figuring out what works for you, and I am much better at being a mother than I ever would have been as a lawyer. I sometimes wonder if it is just me, or if there are other women who figure out where they are supposed to be by going nowhere. I look up from drying Jesse off and find Brian staring at me. "Do you miss it, Sarah?" he asks quietly. I wrap our son in the towel and kiss him on the crown of his head. "Like I'd miss a root canal," I say. By the time I wake up the next morning, Brian has already left for work. He's on 2 days, then 2 nights, and then off for 4, before the cycle repeats again. Glancing at the clock, I realize I've slept past 9. More amazingly, my children have not woken me up. In my bathrobe, I run downstairs, where I find Jesse playing on the floor with blocks. "I ate breakfast," he informs me. "I made some for you, too." Sure enough, there is cereal spilled all over the kitchen table, and a frighteningly precarious chair poised beneath the cabinet that holds the cornflakes. A trail of milk leads from the refrigerator to the bowl. Where's Kate? Sleeping, Jessie says. I tried poking her and everything. My children are a natural alarm clock. The thought of Kate sleeping so late makes me remember that she's been sniffling lately, and then wonder if that's why she was so tired last night. I walk upstairs, calling her name, loud. In her bedroom, she rolls toward me, swimming up from the dark to focus on my face. Rise and shine. I pull up her shades, let the sun spill over her blankets. I sit her up and rub her back. Let's get you dressed, I say, and I peel her pajama top over her head. Trailing her spine, like a line of small blue jewels, are a string of bruises. Anemia, right? I ask the pediatrician. Kids her age don't get mono, do they? Dr. Wayne pulls his stethoscope away from Kate's narrow chest and tugs down her pink shirt. It could be a virus. I'd like to draw some blood and run a few tests. Jessie, who has been patiently playing with a G.I. Joe that has no head, perks up at this news. You know how they draw blood, Kate? Crayons? With needles. Great, big, long ones that they stick in like a shot. Jessie, I warn. Shot? Kate shrieks. Ouch! My daughter, who trusts me to tell her when it's safe to cross the street, to cut her meat in tiny pieces, and to protect her from all sorts of horrible things, like large dogs and darkness and loud firecrackers, stares at me with great expectation. Only a small one, I promise. When the pediatric nurse comes in with her tray, her syringe, her vials, and her rubber tourniquet, Kate starts to scream. I take a deep breath. Kate, look at me. Her cries bubble down to small hiccups. It's just going to be a tiny pinch. Liar, Jessie whispers under his breath. Kate relaxes just the slightest bit. The nurse lays her down on the examination table and asks me to hold down her shoulders. I watch the needle break the white skin of her arm. I hear the sudden scream, but there isn't any blood flowing. Sorry, sugar, the nurse says. I'm going to have to try again. She removes the needle and sticks Kate again, who howls even louder. She struggles in earnest through the first and second vials. By the third, she has gone completely limp. I don't know which is worse. We wait for the results of the blood test. Jessie lies on his belly on the waiting room rug, picking up God knows what sorts of germs from all the sick children who pass through this office. What I want is for the pediatrician to come out, tell me to get Kate home and make her drink lots of orange juice, and wave a prescription for C-Clor in front of us like a magic wand. It is an hour before Dr. Wayne summons us to his office again. Kate's tests were a little problematic, he says, specifically her white cell count. It's much lower than normal. What does that mean? In that moment, I curse myself for going to law school and not med school. I try to remember what white cells even do. She may have some sort of autoimmune deficiency, or it might just be a lab error. He touches Kate's hair. I think, just to be safe, I'm going to send you up to a hematologist at the hospital to repeat the test. I am thinking, you must be kidding. But instead, I watch my hand move of its own accord to take the piece of paper Dr. Wayne offers. Not a prescription, as I'd hoped, but a name. Ileana Farquad, Providence Hospital, Hematology Oncology. Oncology? I shake my head. But that's cancer. I wait for Dr. Wayne to assure me it's only part of the physician's title to explain that the blood lab and the cancer ward simply share a physical location and nothing more. He doesn't. The dispatcher at the fire station tells me that Brian is on a medical call. He left with the rescue truck 20 minutes ago. I hesitate and look down at Kate, who's slumped in one of the plastic seats in the hospital waiting room. A medical call. I think there are crossroads in our lives when we make grand, sweeping decisions without even realizing it. Like scanning the newspaper headline at a red light and therefore missing the rogue van that jumps the line of traffic and causes an accident. Entering a coffee shop on a whim and meeting the man you will marry one day while he's digging for change at the counter. Or this one. Instructing your husband to meet you when for hours you have been convincing yourself this is nothing important at all. Radio him, I say. Tell him we're at the hospital. There is a comfort to having Brian beside me, as if we are now a pair of sentries, a double line of defense. We have been at Providence Hospital for 3 hours, and with every passing minute it gets more difficult to deceive myself into believing that Dr. Wayne made a mistake. Jesse is asleep in a plastic chair. Kate has undergone another traumatic blood draw and a chest x-ray because I mentioned that she has a cold. 5 months, Brian says carefully to the resident sitting in front of him with a clipboard. Then he looks at me. Isn't that when she rolled over? I think so. By now, the doctor has asked us everything from what we were wearing the night Kate was conceived to when she first mastered holding a spoon. Her first word? He asks. Brian smiles. Dada. I meant when. Oh. He frowns. I think she was just shy of one. Excuse me, I say. Can you tell me why any of this is important? It's just a medical history, Mrs. Fitzgerald. We want to know everything we can about your daughter so that we can understand what's wrong with her. Mr. and Mrs. Fitzgerald? A young woman approaches, wearing a lab coat. I'm a phlebotomist. Dr. Farquaad wants me to do a COAG panel on Kate. At her name, Kate blinks up from my lap. She takes one look at the white coat and slides her arms inside the sleeves of her own shirt. Can't you do a finger stick? No, this is really the easiest way. Suddenly I remember how, when I was pregnant with Kate, she would get the hiccups. For hours at a time, my stomach would twitch. Every move she made, even ones that small, forced me to do something I couldn't control. Do you think, I say quietly, that's what I want to hear? When you go down to the cafeteria and ask for coffee, would you like it if someone gave you Coke because it's easier to reach? When you go to pay by credit card, would you like it if you were told that's too much hassle, so you'd better break out your cash? Sarah, Brian's voice is a distant wind. Do you think that it's easy for me to be sitting here with my child and not have any idea what's going on or why you're doing all these tests? Do you think it's easy for her? Since when does anyone get the option to do what's easiest? Sarah. It is only when Brian's hand falls onto my shoulder that I realize how hard I am shaking. One more moment, and then the woman storms away, her clogs striking the tile floor. The minute she is out of sight, I wilt. Sarah, Brian says, what's the matter with you? What's the matter with me? I don't know, Brian, because no one is coming to tell us what's wrong with... He wraps me in his arms, Kate caught between us like a gasp. Shh, he says. He tells me it's going to be all right. And for the first time in my life, I don't believe him. Suddenly, Dr. Farquaad, who we have not seen for hours, comes into the room. I hear there was a little problem with the coagulopathy panel. She pulls up a chair in front of us. Kate's complete blood count had some abnormal results. Her white blood count is very low, 1.3. Her hemoglobin is 7.5. Her hematocrit is 18.4. Her platelets are 81,000, and her neutrophils are 0.6. Numbers like that sometimes indicate an autoimmune disease, but Kate's also presenting with 12% promyelocytes and 5% blasts, and that suggests a leukemic syndrome. Leukemic, I repeat. The word is runny, slippery, like the white of an egg. Dr. Farquaad nods. Leukemia is a blood cancer. Brian only stares at her, his eyes fixed. What does that mean? Think of bone marrow as a child care center for developing cells. Healthy bodies make blood cells that stay in the marrow until they're mature enough to go out and fight disease, or clot, or carry oxygen, or whatever it is that they're supposed to do. In a person with leukemia, the child care center doors are opened too early. Immature blood cells wind up circulating, unable to do their job. It's not always odd to see promyelocytes in a CBC, but when we checked Kate's under a microscope, we could see abnormalities. She looks in turn at each of us. I'll need to do a bone marrow aspiration to confirm this, but it seems that Kate has acute promyelocytic leukemia. My tongue is pinned by the weight of the question that, a moment later, Brian forces out of his own throat. Is she going to die? I want to shake Dr. Farquaad. I want to tell her I will draw the blood for the coag panel myself from Kate's arms if it means she will take back what she said. APL is a very rare subgroup of myeloid leukemia. Only about 1,200 people a year are diagnosed with it. The rate of survival for APL patients is 20-30% if treatment starts immediately. I push the numbers out of my head and instead sink my teeth into the rest of her sentence. There's a treatment, I repeat. Yes, with aggressive treatment, myeloid leukemias carry a survival prognosis of 9 months to 3 years. Last week, I had stood in the doorway of Kate's bedroom, watching her clutch a satin security blanket in her sleep, a shred of fabric she was rarely without. You mark my words, I had whispered to Brian. She'll never give that up. I'm going to have to sew it into the lining of her wedding dress. We'll need to do that bone marrow aspiration. We'll sedate her with a light general anesthetic. And we can draw the coag panel while she's asleep. The doctor leans forward, sympathetic. You need to know that kids beat the odds. Every single day. Okay, Brian says. He claps his hands together, as if he is gearing up for a football game. Okay. Kate pulls her head out of my shirt. Her cheeks are flushed, her expression wary. This is a mistake. This is someone else's unfortunate vial of blood that the doctor has analyzed. Look at my child. At the shine of her flyaway curls and the butterfly flight of her smile, this is not the face of someone dying by degrees. I have only known her for 2 years, but if you took every memory, every moment, if you stretched them end to end, they'd reach forever. They roll up a sheet and tuck it under Kate's belly. They tape her down to the examination table, 2 long strips. One nurse strokes Kate's hand, even after the anesthesia has kicked in and she's asleep. Her lower back is bared for the long needle that will go into her iliac crest to extract marrow. When they gently turn Kate's face to the other side, the tissue paper beneath her cheek is damp. I learn from my own daughter that that you don't have to be awake to cry. Driving home, I am struck by the sudden thought that the world is inflatable. Trees and grass and houses ready to collapse with the single prick of a pin. I have the sense that if I veer the car to the left, smash through the picket fence and the little tyke's playground, it will bounce us back like a rubber bumper. We pass a truck, Batchelder Casket Company, it reads on the side. Drive safely. Isn't that a conflict of interest? Kate sits in her car seat, eating animal crackers. Play, she commands. In the rearview mirror, her face is luminous. Objects are closer than they appear. I watch her hold up the first cracker. What does the tiger say? I manage. Roar! She bites off its head, then waves another cracker. What does the elephant say? Kate giggles, then trumpets through her nose. I wonder if it will happen in her sleep, or if she will cry, if there will be some kind nurse who gives her something for the pain. I envision my child dying while she is happy and laughing 2 feet behind me. Giraffe say? Kate asks. Giraffe? Her voice, it's so full of the future. Giraffes don't say anything, I answer. Why? Because that's how they're born, I tell her, and then my throat swells shut. The phone rings just as I come in from the neighbor's house, having arranged for her to take care of Jesse while we take care of Kate. We have no protocol for this situation. Our only babysitters are still in high school. All 4 grandparents are deceased. We've never dealt with daycare providers. Taking care of the children is my job. By the time I come into the kitchen, Brian is well into conversation with the caller. The phone cord is wrapped around his knees. An umbilicus. Yeah, he says. Hard to believe. I haven't made it into a single game this season. No point now that they've traded him. His eyes meet mine as I put on the kettle for tea. Oh, Sarah's great. And the kids, they're fine. Right. You give my best to Lucy. Thanks for calling, Don. He hangs up. Don Thurman, he explains. From the Fire Academy, remember? Nice guy. As he stares at me, the genial smile sloughs off his face. The tea kettle starts to whistle, but neither of us makes a motion to move it off the burner. I look at Brian, cross my arms. I couldn't, he says quietly. Sarah, I just couldn't. In bed that night, Brian is an obelisk, another shape breaking the darkness. Although we have not spoken for hours, I know that he is every bit as awake as I am. This is happening to us because I yelled at Jesse last week, yesterday, moments ago. This is happening because I didn't buy Kate the M&Ms she wanted at the grocery store. This is happening because once, for a split second, I wondered what my life would have been like if I'd never had children. This is happening because I didn't realize how good I have it. Do you think we did it to her? Brian asks. Did it to her? I turn to him. How? Like our genes, you know. I don't respond. Providence Hospital doesn't know anything, he says fiercely. Do you remember when the chief's son broke his left arm and they put a cast on the right one? I stare at the ceiling again. Just so you know, I say more loudly than I've intended, I'm not going to let Kate die. There is an awful sound beside me. An animal wounded. A drowning gasp. Then Brian presses his face against my shoulder, sobs into my skin. He wraps his arms around me and holds on as if he's losing his balance. I'm not. I repeat. But even to myself, it sounds like I'm trying too hard.
Brian. For every 19 degrees hotter a fire burns, it doubles in size. This is what I'm thinking while I watch sparks shoot out of the incinerator chimney, 1,000 new stars. The dean of Brown University's medical school wrings his hands beside me. In my heavy coat, I'm sweating. We've brought an engine, a ladder, and a rescue truck. We've assessed all four sides of the building. We've confirmed that no one is inside. Well, except for the body that got stuck in the incinerator and caused this. He was a large man, the dean says. This is what we always do with the subjects when the anatomy classes are through. Hey, Gap, Polly yells. Today, he's my main pump operator. Red's got the hydrant dressed. Do you want me to charge a line? I'm not certain yet that I'll take a hose up. This furnace was designed to consume remains at 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. There's fire above and below the body. Well, the dean says, aren't you going to do something? It's the biggest mistake rookies make, the assumption that fighting a fire means rushing in with a stream of water. Sometimes that makes it worse. In this case, it would spread biohazardous waste all over the place. I'm thinking we need to keep the furnace closed and make sure the fire doesn't get out of the chimney. A fire can't burn forever. Eventually, it consumes itself. Yes, I tell him, I'm going to wait and see. When I work the night shift, I eat dinner twice. The first meal is early, an accommodation made by my family so that we can all sit around a table together. Tonight, Sarah makes a roast beef. It sits on the table like a sleeping infant as she calls us for supper. Kate is the first to slip into her seat. Hey, baby, I say, squeezing her hand. When she smiles at me, it doesn't reach her eyes. What have you been up to? She pushes her beans around her plate. Saving third world countries, splitting a few atoms, and finishing up the great American novel. In between dialysis, of course. Of course. Sarah turns around, brandishing a knife. Whatever I did, I say, shrinking away, I'm sorry. She ignores me. Carve the roast, will you? I take the carving utensils and slice into the roast beef, just as Jesse sloughs into the kitchen. We allow him to live over the garage, but he's required to eat with us. It's part of the bargain. His eyes are devil red. His clothes are ringed with sweet smoke. Look at that! Sarah sighs, but when I turn, she's staring at the roast. It's too rare. She picks the pan up with her bare hands as if her skin is coated with asbestos. She sticks the beef back into the oven. Jesse reaches for a bowl of mashed potatoes and begins to heap them onto his plate. More and more and more again. You reek, Kate says, waving her hand in front of her face. Jesse ignores her, taking a bite of his potatoes. I wonder what it says about me, that I'm actually thrilled I can identify pot running through his system, as opposed to some of the others, ecstasy, heroin, and God knows what else, which leave less of a trace.
Not all of us enjoy Ode to Stoned, Kate mutters.
Not all of us can get our drugs through a port-a-cath, Jesse answers. Sarah holds up her hands. Please, could we just not? Where's Anna? Kate asks.
Wasn't she in your room?
Not since this morning. Sarah sticks her head through the kitchen door. Anna, dinner! Look at what I bought today, Kate says, plucking at her t-shirt. It's a psychedelic tie-dye with a crab on the front and the word cancer. Get it?
You're a Leo.
Sarah looks like she's on the verge of tears. How's that roast coming? I ask to distract her. Just then, Anna enters the kitchen. She throws herself into her chair and ducks her head.
Where have you been? Kate says. Around.
Anna looks down at her plate, but makes no effort to serve herself. This isn't Anna. I'm used to struggling with Jesse, to lightening Kate's load, but Anna is our family's constant. Anna comes in with a smile. Anna tells us about the robin she found with a broken wing and a blush on its cheek, or about the mother she saw at Walmart with not one but two sets of twins. Anna gives us a backbeat, and seeing her sitting there unresponsive makes me realize that silence has a sound. "Something happened today?" I ask. She looks up at Kate, assuming the question has been put to her sister, and then startles when she realizes I'm talking to her. "No." "You feel okay?" Again, Anna does a double take. This is a question we usually reserve for Kate. "Fine. Because you're, you know, not eating." Anna looks down on her plate, notices that it's empty, and then heaps it high with food. She shovels green beans into her mouth, two forkfuls. Out of the blue, I remember when the kids were little, crammed into the back of the car like cigars wedged in a box, and I would sing to them, "Anna, Anna, Bobana, Banana, Fana, Fofana, Me, My, Momana, Anna." "Chuck," Jesse would yell out, "do Chuck." "Hey," Kate points to Anna's neck, "your locket's missing." It's the one I gave her years ago. Anna's hand comes up to her collarbone. "Did you lose it?" I ask. She shrugs. "Maybe I'm just not in the mood to wear it." She's never taken it off, far as I know. Sarah pulls the roast out of the oven and sets it on the table. As she picks up the knife to carve, she looks over at Kate. "Speaking of things we're not in the mood to wear," she says, "go put on another shirt." "Why?" "Because I said so. That's not a reason." Sarah spears the roast with the knife. "Because I find it offensive at the dinner table." "It's not any more offensive than Jesse's metalhead shirts. What's the one you had on yesterday, Alabama Thunder Pussy?" Jesse rolls his eyes toward her. It's an expression I've seen before. The horse in a spaghetti western gone lame the moment before it's shot for mercy. Sarah saws through the meat. Pink before, now it's an overcooked log. "Now look," she says. "It's ruined." "It's fine." I take the one piece she's managed to dissect from the rest and cut a smaller bite. I might as well be chewing leather. "Delicious. I'm just going to run down to the station, get a blowtorch so that we can serve everyone else." Sarah blinks, and then a laugh bubbles out of her. Kate giggles. Even Jesse cracks a smile. This is when I realize that Anna has already left the table, and more importantly, that nobody noticed. Back at the station, the four of us sit upstairs in the kitchen. Red's got some kind of sauce going on the stove. Polly reads the Projo, and Caesar's writing a letter to this week's Object of Lust. Watching him, Red shakes his head. "Yeah, just keep that filed on disk and print multiple copies at a time." Caesar's just a nickname Polly coined years ago because he's always Roman. "Well, this one's different," Caesar says. "Yeah, she lasted 2 whole days. Red pours the pasta into the colander and the sink, steam rising up around his face. "Fitz, give the boy some pointers, will you?" "Why me?" Polly glances up over the rim of the paper. "Default," he says, and it's true. Polly's wife left him 2 years ago for a cellist who'd swung through Providence on a symphony tour. Red's such a confirmed bachelor, he wouldn't know what a lady was if she came up and bit him. On the other hand, Sarah and I have been married 20 years. Red sets a plate down in front of me as I start to talk. "A woman," I say, "isn't all that different from a bonfire." Polly tosses down the paper and hoots. "Here we go, the Tao of Captain Fitzgerald." I ignore him. "A fire's a beautiful thing, right? Something you can't take your eyes off of when it's burning. If you can keep it contained, it'll throw light and heat for you. It's only when it gets out of control that you have to go on the offensive." "What Cap is trying to tell you," Polly says, "is that you need to keep your date away from crosswinds. Hey, Red, you got any Parmesan?" We sit down to my second dinner, which usually means that the bells will ring within minutes.
Firefighting is a world of Murphy's Law, and it's when you can least afford a crisis that one crops up. Hey, Fitz, do you remember the last dead guy who got stuck? Polly asks. Back when we were volleys? God, yes. A fellow who weighed 500 pounds if he weighed an ounce, who died of heart failure in his bed. The fire department had been called in on that one by the funeral home, which couldn't get the body downstairs. Ropes and pulleys, I recall out loud. And he was supposed to be cremated, but he was too big, Polly grins. Swear to God, as my mother's up in heaven, they had to take him to a vet instead. Caesar blinks up at him. What for? How do you think they get rid of a dead horse, Einstein? Putting two and two together, Caesar's eyes widen. No kidding, he says. And on second thought, pushes away Red's pasta bolognese. Who do you think the last to clean out the med school chimney? Red says. The poor OSHA bastards, Polly answers. $10 say they'll call here and tell us it's our job. There won't be any call, I say, because there won't be anything left to clean out. That fire was burning too hot. Well, at least we know this one wasn't arson, Polly mutters. In the past month, we've had a rash of fire set intentionally. You can always tell. There'll be splash patterns of flammable liquid, or multiple points of origin, or smoke that burns black, or an unusual concentration of fire in one spot. Whoever's doing this is smart, too. At several structures, the combustibles have been put beneath stairs to cut off our access to the flames. Arson fires are dangerous because they don't follow the science we use to combat them. Arson fires are the structures most likely to collapse around you while you're inside fighting them. Caesar snorts. Maybe it was. Maybe that fat guy was really a suicide arsonist. He crawled up into the chimney and lit himself on fire. Maybe he was just desperate to lose weight, Polly adds, and the other guys crack up. Enough, I say. Ah, Fitz, you gotta admit, it's pretty funny. Not to that man's parents, not to his family. There's that uncomfortable silence as the other men grasp at words. Finally, Polly, who's known me the longest, speaks. Something going on with Kate again, Fitz. There's always something going on with my eldest daughter. The problem is, it never seems to end. I push away from the table and set my plate in the sink. I'm going up to the roof. We all have our hobbies. Caesar's got his girls, Polly his bagpipes, Red his cooking, and me, I have my telescope. I mounted it years ago on the roof of the fire station where I can get the best view of the night sky. If I weren't a fireman, I'd be an astronomer. It takes too much math for my brain, I know that, but there's always been something about charting the stars that appeals to me. On a really dark night, you can see between 1,000 and 1,500 stars, and there are millions more that haven't been discovered. It's so easy to think that the world revolves around you, but all you have to do is stare up at the sky to realize it isn't that way at all. Anna's real name is Andromeda. It's on her birth certificate, honest to God. The constellation she's named after tells the story of a princess who was shackled to a rock as a sacrifice to a sea monster, punishment for her mother, Cassiopeia, who had bragged to Poseidon about her own beauty. Perseus, flying by, fell in love with Andromeda and saved her. In the sky, she's pictured with her arms outstretched and her hands chained. The way I saw it, the story had a happy ending. Who wouldn't want that for a child? When Kate was born, I used to imagine how beautiful she would be on her wedding day. Then she was diagnosed with APL, and instead, I'd imagine her walking across the stage to get her high school diploma. When she relapsed, all this went out the window. I pictured her making it to her fifth birthday party. Nowadays, I don't have expectations, and this way, she beats them all. Kate is going to die. It took me a long time to be able to say that. We're all going to die when you get down to it, but it's not supposed to be like this. Kate ought to be the one who has to say goodbye to me. It almost seems like a cheat that after all these years of defying the odds, it won't be the leukemia that kills her. Then again, Dr. Chance told us a long time ago that this was how it usually worked. A patient's body just gets worn down from all the fighting. Little by little, pieces of them start to give up. In Kate's case, it's her kidneys. I turn my telescope to Barnard's loop, an M42 glowing in Orion's sword. Stars are fires that burn for thousands of years. Some of them burn slow and long, like red dwarfs. Others, blue giants, burn their fuel so fast they shine across great distances and are easy to see. As they start to run out of fuel, they burn helium, grow even hotter, and explode in a supernova. Supernovas. They're brighter than the brightest galaxies. They die, but everyone watches them go. Earlier, after we ate, I helped Sarah clean up in the kitchen. "You think something's going on with Anna?" I asked, moving the ketchup back into the fridge. "Because she took off her necklace?" "No," I shrugged, "just in general."
"Compared to Kate's kidneys and Jesse's sociopathy, I'd say she's doing fine."
"She wanted dinner over before it started." Sarah turned around at the sink.
"What do you think it is?"
A guy?" Sarah glanced at me. "She's not dating anyone." "Thank God." "Maybe one of her friends said something to upset her." Why was Sarah asking me? What the hell did I know about the mood swings of 13-year-old girls? Sarah wiped her hands on a towel and turned on the dishwasher. "Maybe she's just being a teenager." I tried to think back to what Kate was like when she was 13, but all I could remember was the relapse and the stem cell transplant she had. Kate's ordinary life had a way of fading into the background, overshadowed by the times she was sick.
"I have to take Kate to dialysis tomorrow," Sarah said. "When will you get home?"
"By 8. But I'm on call, and I wouldn't be surprised if our arsonist struck again."
"Brian," she asked, "how did Kate look to you?"
"Better than Anna did," I thought. But this wasn't what she was asking. She wanted me to measure the yellow cast of Kate's skin against yesterday. She wanted me to read into the way she leaned her elbows on the table, too tired to hold her body upright. "Kate looks great," I lied, because this is what we do for each other.
"Don't forget to say goodnight to them before you leave," Sarah said, and she turned to gather the pills Kate takes at bedtime.
It's quiet tonight. Weeks have rhythms all their own, and the craziness of a Friday or Saturday night shift stands in direct contrast to a dull Sunday or Monday. I can already tell this will be one of those nights where I bunk down and actually get to sleep.
"Daddy?"
The hatch to the roof opens, and Anna crawls out.
"Red told me you were up here."
Immediately I freeze. It's 10 o'clock at night. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing. I just wanted to visit."
When the kids were small, Sarah would stop by with them all the time. They'd play in the bays around the sleeping giant engines. They'd fall asleep upstairs in my bunk. Sometimes, in the warmest part of the summer, Sarah would bring along an old blanket, and we'd spread it here on the roof, lie down with the kids between us, and watch the night rise. "Mom know where you are?"
"She dropped me off."
Anna tiptoes across the roof. She's never been all that great with heights, and there's only a 3-inch lip around the concrete. Squinting, she bends to the telescope.
"What can you see?"
"Vega," I tell her. I take a good look at Anna, something I haven't done in some time. She's not stick straight anymore. She's got the beginnings of curves. Even her motions, tucking her hair behind her ear, peering into the telescope, have a sort of grace I associate with full-grown women. "Got something you want to talk about?" Her teeth snag on her bottom lip, and she looks down at her sneakers.
"Maybe, instead, you could talk to me," Anna suggests.
So I sit her down on my jacket and point to the stars. I tell her that Vega is a part of Lyra, the lyre that belonged to Orpheus. I'm not one for stories, but I remember the ones that match up with the constellations. I tell her about this son of the sun god whose music charmed animals and softened boulders. A man who loved his wife, Eurydice, so much that he wouldn't let death take her away. By the time I finish, we're lying flat on our backs.
"Can I stay here with you?"
Anna asks. I kiss the top of her head. "You bet."
"Daddy,"
Anna whispers, when I think for sure she's fallen asleep.
"Did it work?"
It takes me a moment to understand she's talking about Orpheus and Eurydice. "No," I admit. She lets loose a sigh.
"Figures,"
she says.
Tuesday. From A Few Figs from Thistles by Edna St. Vincent Millay. First Fig. My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. Anna. I used to pretend that I was just passing through this family on my way to my real one. It isn't too much of a stretch, really. There's Kate, the spitting image of my dad, and Jessie, the spitting image of my mom. And then there's me, a collection of recessive